The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Okay, David, let's start with the sound. What was that?
Well, Sarah, that sound is part of the triumph display of the male white flippered penguin. And this is a penguin that tends to get in a lot of fights, especially there's a colony in Flea Bay in New Zealand of these guys that are particularly aggressive. Some penguins in this colony are actually missing eyes to show you how much and how aggressively these guys fight. And when the winner wins the fight, they make that sound that you just played, and they do a bit of a dance too, complete with flipper waving. It's sort of the male penguins, the winner's way of saying, I'm victorious, I'm the man, I'm the boss, you better not fight me again.
So is that what scientists decided it actually means?
Well, scientists kind of know that that's what it means for the loser. When the victor makes this noise and makes this display, the loser, at least in other bird species, seems to be less likely to challenge that victor penguin again. What scientists did know is what effect all of this displaying has on the audience, because these fights tend to have an audience of male and female penguins. And the question was, do the spectators take anything away from the call as well as the loser does?
So how did they test how the bystanders felt about these champions' calls?
Well, sir, what they did was they actually took recordings of penguin fights and they stitched them together into fight sounds, and the fights sometimes ended with this braying call of the victor. Sometimes they ended with a call from the loser, which is not as sort of dramatic. And then they played these manufactured audio recordings to a group of 43 bystander penguins. And near these penguins, they actually placed these fake eggs, these infrared eggs that actually measured the penguin's heart rate, because they wanted to get a sense of how stressed out these bystander penguins would be when they heard these sounds. These speakers that were playing these sounds were about 5 meters away. After about 5 minutes, when the sounds were done, they moved the speakers to 2.5 meters away, so they were a lot closer to these penguins. And then they played the call of the winner or the loser. And the idea was to trick these bystanders into thinking that the winner or the loser was approaching. And what the researchers found was that both male and female bystanders got stressed out when they were listening to fights, with females similarly stressed out regardless of whether the winner or the loser approached their burrows after the fight. But males were much more stressed out if a winner rather than a loser approached their burrows, and they were much more likely to challenge a loser that was approaching than challenge a winner. And the fundamental conclusion is that when the victors make these sounds and these displays when they win, it's not only a signal to the loser, like, hey, you better not mess with me again. It's also sort of a signal to everybody in the crowd. It's like, hey, don't you even think about fighting with me, messing with me.
Right.
It's sort of a display that affects everyone.
So they're delaying maybe more fights that they might have ended up going into.
Exactly.
Very cool. Next, let's talk about an ancient mammal that survived the extinction of the dinosaurs but is no longer around today.
Well, Sarah, this is actually a group of creatures known as multituberculates, and these were mouse-sized, sometimes slightly larger mammals that first arose about 165 million years ago. And as you stated, they lasted a long time. They actually were around until about 34 million years ago, which means that they were around long after the dinosaurs went extinct, which was about 65 million years ago. The question is, how did they survive and how much did they sort of proliferate before they died out? And the only way researchers can really get at that mystery is to figure out what these animals were eating during their lifetime, which has really been sort of up in the air. Scientists have speculated that they munched on everything from grains to insects to even meteor prey, but nobody really knew for sure. And that's what, sort of what this new study is all about.
And so how did they look into something that happened so long ago?
Well, what they did was they looked at 48 fossils that represented 41 different groups of these multituberculates, and they looked at a subset of their teeth, actually their cheek teeth. They were looking for distinct surfaces on these teeth, which they refer to as facets. And the idea is that mammals with a low number of facets typically are meat eaters. And the reason is because they don't do a lot with their teeth. They just sort of like gnaw off a piece of flesh and swallow it, and they let their stomach do all the work. But creatures with a lot more facets on their teeth, a lot more bumps and grooves and things like that, they tend to eat a lot more plants and nuts and things that require a lot of chewing before they get digested. And so the idea would be to find out with these multituberculates, how did their teeth change over time? And what researchers found is that a long, long time ago, when the multituberculates first arose, their teeth didn't have a lot of these facets, which means that they were probably eating a lot of meat. But as the group evolved over time, a lot more of its members started to develop much more complicated teeth with a lot more of these grooves and other facets in them. And by the time the dinosaurs went extinct, these multituberculates were already, according to their teeth at least, a lot of them were full-blown herbivores, which means they were eating a mixed diet dominated by plants rather than feasting on insects or other small, meaty prey.
So is there anything else besides the extinction of the dinosaurs that may have something to do with this expansion in their diet?
Well, so one of the big going hypotheses about the extinction of the dinosaurs is that mammals really weren't doing a lot while the dinosaurs were around. Mammals were really small. They sort of hung out in the background. They weren't diversifying. They weren't proliferating because the dinosaurs were basically just dominating everything. And then all of a sudden, when the dinosaurs went extinct, now we could have this explosion of mammals where mammals start getting bigger and diversifying on all this other stuff. Well, what this study suggests is that even before the dinosaurs kicked the bucket, multituberculates were already starting to diversify. And the reason might be because around the time that they were starting to diversify also coincided with an explosion in flowering plants known as angiosperms. And these were plants that were really themselves diversifying into a lot of different forms, trees, herbaceous plants. And the idea would be to take advantage of that, these multituberculates would have diversified to feed on them, which would have required developing much more complicated teeth, which means that this group was really undergoing an explosion. They didn't have to wait for the dinosaurs to die out. They already had sort of a spark to cause them to sort of diversify.
So they survived the dinosaur extinction and they diversified quite a bit, but then they didn't survive to modern times. What do the scientists think happened?
Well, that's a great question. You know, they mysteriously disappeared about 34 million years ago, even though they had really diversified. And nobody really knows the answer, but one expert we quote in the article says that it's possible that they were outcompeted by other creatures, rodents, primates, other mammals, all the other mammals that were really starting to come into their own around 30 million years ago or so, really drove these guys out of the equation.
Interesting. Last up, we have a story on how corals may be more adaptive than thought when it comes to global warming.
That's right. Sarah, you know, when we think about global warming, one of the big visuals that is evidence of the devastating impacts of a warming Earth is something called coral bleaching. And this is when corals, which are typically very colorful underwater, turn white, essentially, and die soon afterwards. And the reason is because corals rely on symbiotic algae, and these algae not only give them their color, but actually produce nutrients that the corals need to survive. But when the waters get too warm, it upsets this delicate and symbiotic balance, and the corals expel the algae, they turn white, and they eventually die because they're not getting their nutrients anymore. And researchers have seen this in waters that are warming around the world.
So warmer water can really harm these corals. That sounds like bad news.
Well, Sarah, what this study, this new study is finding is basically that it may not all be bad news for corals. That sometimes they can recover from these bleaching events. What the study entails is researchers looked at a 2010 bleaching episode. They looked at three different coral reef sites, all that suffered from bleaching in 2010. One was in Indonesia, and what was interesting about this site, the researchers hadn't recorded a bleaching event here previously, and the corals here did very poorly. There was a fast-growing coral known as Acropora, which just suffered massive die-offs. But what was interesting is the researchers looked at a couple other sites, one in Singapore and one in Malaysia, that also had this fast-growing Acropora species. And this time, Acropora seemed to be doing very well despite the bleaching event. And what was different about this site was this site had also suffered a bleaching event in 1998. And the idea would be that Acropora, maybe because it's so fast-growing, may have evolved some sort of resistance to bleaching, or perhaps just due to natural selection, the strongest Acropora from the bleaching event in 1998 survived, and they were just much hardier when the water warmed again, and they did not die off in such large numbers. So this is a kind of a preliminary study. It's just based on a few locations. But what it suggests is that some coral may not be as susceptible to bleaching events as previously thought, and some of these reefs, which are really important for marine diversity, which is why we care about the bleaching of these coral reefs in the first place, may be able to survive global warming better than thought. Now, it's still, on balance, bad news, but there is a little bit of hope here.
So it seems that it's an open question about how big of an impact global warming will have on corals.
Exactly.
All right. So what else did you have on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how an HIV drug may help protect against malaria. Also a story about why giant squid have such giant eyes. Their eyes are actually the size of soccer balls. We'll tell you why that is. For Science Insider, we've got a story about how animal rights activists have impacted ferry service from the UK to the rest of Europe. Also a story about why more than 100 organizations are calling for a moratorium on synthetic biology. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is on the ecological impact of climate change on the seasons. Why do seasons appear to be arriving earlier and earlier? Be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.